The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Washington Post, AAA Go Magazine, and the News and Observer. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. Now, they are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. And on today's Armchair Traveler, we begin in search of a good meal. Yep, we start with magical meals in a Massachusetts town, written by Alexandra Petchy and published in the March 15th, 2018 issue of the Washington Post. Salem. The name alone conjures specters of skeletal tree branches stretching toward a misty, moonlit Massachusetts sky, menacing black-cloaked Puritans and witches, ghosts and ghouls lurking around every brick-paved corner. It's true that Salem has both earned and cultivated its spooky reputation as the Halloween capital of the world. Yet in recent years, the witch city has also become a food city, dense with creative restaurants, cafes, patisseries, breweries, a distillery, and, just like any self-respecting foodie town, a food tour. Tucked on a quiet side street in the heart of downtown is A&J King Artisan Bakers, and you'll find them online at ajkingbakery.com. They're at 48 Central Street, where husband and wife team Andy and Jackie King craft a delicious array of lovingly made breads, pastries, and sweetbreads made from locally sourced, seasonally available ingredients. The cozy, rustic industrial space is packed with locals sipping coffee, knitting, reading the newspaper, and catching up with friends around small, copper-top tables. Tuck into featured breakfast pastries such as the savory mushroom croissant, $4.25, please, rondelet with oyster mushrooms, goat cheese, shallots, and thyme, or the pain al raisin for $3.65, made with rum from Salem's own Deacon Giles Distillery. Try the seasonal danishes at $2.95 in rotating flavors such as garlic scape pesto with cherry tomatoes or sweet lemon cream cheese with mixed berries. You also can't go wrong with a fat slice of sour cream coffee cake with a thick walnut cinnamon topping at $2.50. Then there's a blueberry muffin for $2.85 or even a loaf of artisanal bread or a bag of homemade granola for $8.30. You can have that for later. And everything down to the caramel syrup swirled through cappuccinos, chai for lattes, and chocolate ganache, all made on site. Salem was one of America's most important seaports for international trade in spices, tea, silks, and other exotic goods during the late 18th and early 19th centuries. That maritime legacy means sampling seafood is de rigueur in Salem, and Sea Level Oyster Bar, found online at sealeveloysterbar.com, is at 94 Wharf Street, and it offers the perfect spot perched at the edge of Salem Harbor on Pickering Wharf and overlooking the Salem National Maritime Historic Site and Derby Wharf Light Station. Alfresco dining on the deck is lovely during the warm weather, but scenic views are guaranteed any time of year in the expansive two-floor restaurant. As the name promises, the oysters, market price at Sea Level's Raw Bar, play a starring role on the menu, but there are lots of New England classics for people who aren't fancy fans of the briny bivalves, including densely packed lobster rolls, also sold at market price, rich, buttery, crumbled Ritz cracker-topped seafood pie, that sounds yummy, for $22, and creamy New England clam chowder for $7. If seafood isn't your thing, you're still in luck thanks to options such as sweet potato, kale, and goat cheese pizza for $13, pickled pear salad with goat cheese, blueberries, and sugared walnuts for $8, and a fried pickle-top burger for $15. Bambolina. BambolinaRestaurant.com is where you'll find more information about these folks. They're at 288 Derby Street. It's serious about its Neapolitan-style pizza without even being a little bit pretentious about it. Shared plates are standouts here, and there are lots of options, such as Italian street corn for $6, roasted corn on the cob loaded with a tangy mix of house Caesar dressing, ricotta, salata, grana padano cheeses, and a healthy dash of Espelette pepper powder, the garlicky fire-roasted Castle Vetrano olives for $6, and the zucchini ceviche, a light salad of greens, zucchini ribbons, ricotta salata, and lemon dressing. The charcuterie is another great shared option, whether you choose individual plates such as the rabbit and pork pâté for $11 and corned beef tongue, $8, or you opt for a board of five chef-selected items and garnishes at $24. For dinner, it's all about the pizza. For purists, there's the margherita for $13.50. Crispy edges, soft interior, topped with tomato, pecorino and mozzarella, and whole fresh basil leaves. Then there's the sweet, savory, and super satisfying beef and blue for $16.50 with cured beef, gorgonzola cheese, caramelized pearl onions, the gentlest hint of honey. Wash it all down with wines by the glass or craft beers such as the Greenhead IPA, made just a few miles up the coast by Newberry Port Brewing. Writer Alexander Peachy lives in New Hampshire, and I suspect we'll be hearing more from her in future episodes of Armchair Traveler. Writer Brian Richards tells us it's time for travelers to enjoy brewed awakenings. We find his article, which covers craft drafts in the Carolinas, in the July-August 2018 issue of AAA Go Magazine. With the brewery count in the United States eclipsing 6,000 and no glimpse of a slowdown, it's a wonder how any brewery can differentiate itself from those located across the street or across town. However, advances in the brewing process, a quest to revitalize forgotten beer styles, and the general community feel of a brewery have demonstrated that no two beers or brewery experiences are the same. In the Carolinas, we are privy to a craft beer movement that's uniquely its own. To showcase the vibrancy of our local breweries, we've highlighted four breweries that, through rehabilitating old landmarks or incorporating local terroir into beer, are providing a true taste of Carolina craft beer. First up is Benford Brewing Company in Lancaster, South Carolina. The drive out to Benford Brewing, South Carolina's first certified agricultural brewery in rural Lancaster County, is the kind of drive where you want to roll down your car window and take in the fresh country air as you pass by fields of corn and horses grazing. The kind of drive that you never want to end, and if you're not looking for the small stainless steel sign marking the drive to Benford Brewing, might not. One of the things people love is if you really want to unplug, says Brian O'Neill, brewery owner and brewmaster, there's only one spot on the property where your cell phone works. We won't tell you where it is unless you really want to know. Once you sit down on a picnic table with a pint of Irish honey ale, a golden pale ale brewed not only from water sourced from the property's three natural springs, but also with locally produced honey, you won't want to use your cell phone anyway. Before you make the trek, remember that Benford is only open on Saturdays from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. Then we go to the Carolina Bauernhaus in Anderson, South Carolina. Our brewing philosophy is regional and seasonal ingredients, says Keston Helfrich, co-founder and head brewer at Carolina Bauernhaus. All of our yeast are wild-caught locally. We're trying to capture a sense of our place in beers. The sense of place is epitomized in Carolina's Bauernhaus's Source Series Opuntia, the mixed culture rye saison that won the brewery a coveted gold medal at the 2017 Great American Beer Festival in the experimental beer category. The farmhouse ale is aged in wine barrels, then finished with a second aging on a bed of prickly pears, which are plentiful in Anderson. Coming out of the gates brewing, mostly sours and wild ales, is a bold move for the first brewery in a town the size of Anderson. However, the nuanced beers fit in well with the revitalization the rest of downtown Anderson is embracing. We want you to feel like you're in the brewery, says Helfrich of the taproom experience. You come in and see a forest of barrels, turn the corner, and the bar is right there. That adds to the education process. You can see it, smell it, and hear it. Now on to Fonta Flora Brewery, Morganton, North Carolina. Alpha versus Beta Carotene IPA with carrots and beets, rhymes, and a Life Appalachian Saison with beets may sound like odd beer offerings to most, but they don't to fans of Morganton's Fonta Flora Brewery. The brewery, which specializes in incorporating local flora into their beers, has become so popular that they've outgrown the downtown Morganton space. It has become a pilgrimage for craft beer aficionados. Fonta Flora plans to open a second brewery up the road in Nebo this summer. We love teaching people about why we brew the way we do, to teach people about agriculture and foraging and the community around those activities, says Sarah Maya, a manager at Fonta Flora. That mission will continue on what was once a portion of the Whippoorwill Dairy Farm. The property will not only host a new brewing facility and tasting room, but it's also home to a small farm where the brewery team has planted beets, carrots, sweet potatoes, scuppernong grapes, wild plums, pawpaw, and elderberries, all under the backdrop of Shortoff Mountain and Linville Gorge. Completing the education process is a walking trail highlighting flora found in western North Carolina that can be foraged for medicinal and food purposes. Burial Beer Company, what an interesting name there, huh? Asheville, North Carolina. Tell me, if you've heard this story before, a brewery opens, quickly outgrows its humble beginnings, and opens a second facility even more impressive than the original. Oh, wait. Much like Fonta Flora, Burial Beer saw their utilitarian tap room on Asheville's South Slope grow from a brewery popular among locals to one of North Carolina's most visited breweries. Soon, demand for Burial Beer's culinary-inspired brews like their coffee saison and coconut brown ale grew so much that they opened an additional brew house with eight times the original brewing capacity. Opening this summer, Burial's new home, dubbed Forestry Camp, was built in the early 1900s as the home to the Civilian Conservation Corps, who helped build the Blue Ridge Parkway. The six-building craft beer mecca allows brewery visitors to get up close and personal to the brewing process with a viewable brewing space and barrel aging facility. The main draw is the two-story tasting room highlighting beers from Burial and other craft beers curated locally, nationally, and internationally. The original brewery and tasting room will remain open as Burial's wild fermentation facility, so you can still take a selfie in front of the Tom Selleck and Sloth mural that beautifully decorates the outside wall. These are just a few of the many delicious breweries across our region. Don't be afraid to hit the road this summer with a diversion or two at a new-to-you brewery. Sounds like lots of fun there, huh? Well, next we're going to focus on points of interest we might overlook while traveling. We've had some episodes talking about this. Writer Sam Roberts of the New York Times is going to help us with this one, to find the hidden gems along world-famous Broadway. His article comes from the June 24th, 2018 issue of the News and Observer. I am three blocks from the Broadway local subway stop, just past West 204th Street. Right before me is a time machine capable of transporting me back to when most of Manhattan north of Canal Street consisted of hilly meadows, orchards, and plowed fields. The Dyckman Farmhouse and Museum is the oldest remaining farmhouse in the borough, made of fieldstone, brick, and white clapboard with a gambrel room and Dutch door, dating from about 1783, a magical stop on Broadway's least discovered northern stretch. Broadway is arguably the most famous thoroughfare in the world by one measure, 250 million hits on Google versus 6 million for the Champs-Élysées. But in the city that never stops recycling itself, it takes a discerning flaneur to find the new original landmarks like this one that have survived along Broadway's 13-mile route from one end of Manhattan to the other. Most guidebooks to Broadway begin at the Battery, named since the 17th century for the artillery placed there to protect the settlers from an invading fleet, and focus on Bowling Green, Trinity Church, St. Paul's Chapel, the Sun Building, Flatiron Building, and Schubert Alley in Times Square. But on a drizzly morning recently, Fran Leiden, a City College of New York architecture professor and the author of a new book, Broadway, A History of the New York City in 13 Miles, published by W.W. Norton, hosted a two-person walking excursion of the less-traveled blocks on the final stretch, beginning just before Broadway merges with Riverside Drive and Dyckman Street. The mission was to find some of the thoroughfare's hidden historical treasures, the sites often overlooked by neighborhood residents as well as tourists. Our tour of the two northernmost miles included what was once a Gilded Age enclave in Inwood, where Broadway is flanked by idiosyncratic historical sites that are not only neglected by most visitors' guides, but eclipsed by the street's commercial bustle. The first anomaly is the Dyckman Farmhouse and Museum, open for public tours. The Flemish colonial house faces two buildings across the street. One, incongruously, is a gas station. In the other, a relative newcomer to the gentrifying neighborhood, the Dyckmans have felt right at home. It's a beer garden. A little farther north, now the site of a mini-storage warehouse, is where the Benedetto family operated the last working farm in Manhattan until the mid-1950s, and where rhubarb jam now sells for $6.90 a jar in a French grocery. On the west side of Broadway, starting around 212th Street, is Isham Park, once the location of an Italianate villa owned by the leather merchant William B. Isham, on a promontory with sweeping views of both the Hudson and Harlem Rivers. Near the entrance is a brown milestone, presumably an original marker that was set into the wall. If you look closely in the driveway of an auto repair shop between 215th and 218th Streets, you can see a crumbling marble replica of the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. The graffiti-scarred relic, dating from 1855, was the gateway to a grand 25-acre hilltop summer estate, now the site of the Park Terrace Gardens apartments belonging to John F. Seaman and his heiress wife, an eccentric descendant of Sir Francis Drake. Also near 215th Street is the majestic flight of 110 steps, which evoke the Rue Favitur and Montmartre. The steps connect Broadway with the Park Terrace East and Inwood Hill Park, and supposedly the site of the storied $24 purchase of Manhattan from the Indians. Certainly the first half of Broadway as it developed was without question the economic engine of the city, Leadon said, and it's the city's spine, the thing that unites and divides downtown, the snootier dollar side to the west versus the cheaper shilling side in the early 19th century, and in Washington Heights, the Jews to the west and Dominicans to the east more recently. Leadon, who grew up in Gainesville, Florida, and lives in Brooklyn with his family, first saw Broadway from the air while flying to Boston on a field trip from the University of Florida, then visited Times Square while studying architecture at Yale. He was inspired to devote an entire book to Broadway 8 years ago after collaborating on the AIA Guide to New York City and discovering that, except for the David Dunlap's exuberant On Broadway 1990, few other authors had done their urban anthropology spade work. What surprised him most were how many lives now, including his own, were entwined with the history of the street. George Washington, who worshipped at St. Paul's Chapel, entrepreneurs like F.W. Warworth and A.T. Stewart, whose commercial flagships flanked City Hall, the iconic figures who were feted with tons of ticker tape in the Canyon of Heroes, the loiterers who gawked at skirts sent billowing by the wind tunnel that the Flatiron Building created at 23rd Street, and the ghost along the stretch of Broadway that undulates past Times Square, whose reputation for bright lights and shattered dreams were epitomized in its legacy as the Great White Way and the street of broken hearts. The street has always been more a state of mind than a mere physical space, one that has defied the unbending Manhattan grid for two centuries as it snaked uptown, and that even now, defying its name, is being narrowed to accommodate pedestrian plazas. Well, one of the biggest hits on modern Broadway is now on an off-Broadway tour. Writer Ashraf Khalil of the Associated Press reveals that D.C. preps as only it can for the arrival of Hamilton. His article is from the June 24, 2018 issue of the News and Observer. The blockbuster musical, Hamilton, is finally coming to the nation's capital, and the city is preparing in ways that only Washington can. Lin-Manuel Miranda's genre-bending historical musical about the life of Alexander Hamilton is starting a three-month run at the Kennedy Center on Tuesday. Hamilton didn't actually spend much of his life or professional career in Washington. The U.S. Capitol was in Philadelphia when he served as the nation's first Treasury Secretary, and the federal government didn't move to Washington until 1800, 4 years before his death. However, the myriad museums of modern Washington have been preparing specialized exhibits designed to appeal to tourists and locals who can't get the tunes out of their heads. D.C. seems like the sort of town that's tailor-made for this sort of wonky nerding out over a former Secretary of the Treasury, said Daniel Piazza, chief curator of the stamp collections at the Smithsonian's National Postal Museum. The Postal Museum has already launched an exhibit, Alexander Hamilton, Soldier Secretary Icon, that includes mail portraits and postage and revenue stamps reflective of Hamilton's life and career. But the real prize of the exhibit are the two flintlock pistols made of walnut, brass, and gold that were used in the July 11, 1804 duel with Vice President Aaron Burr, which resulted in Hamilton's death. The pistols are on loan from the private collection of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company. They will only be on display through June 24th, although the museum's larger Hamilton exhibit will continue through next year. The Library of Congress is unveiling its own Hamilton display, drawing on its collection of more than 12,000 of Hamilton's papers and documents. Much of it will have direct connections and references that fans of the musical will recognize, according to curator Julie Miller. Miranda based his musical on a 2004 biography, Alexander Hamilton, by Ron Chernow, which drew from much of the same material. Miller said the exhibit includes a letter from Hamilton to his wife, Elizabeth Schuyler, in which he refers to her as the best of wives and the best of women, a line quoted verbatim in the musical. There's also material chronicling a historically important dinner meeting with Hamilton and Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson. That meeting is at the heart of the song, The Room Where It Happens. The Library of Congress is supplementing its physical exhibit by making a vast number of Hamilton-related papers accessible online. These include a manuscript of the Reynolds pamphlet, Hamilton's 100-page public response to his involvement in what was essentially the first American political sex scandal. That controversy merited a song of the same name in the musical. Well, what's new at theme parks? Well, the answer might be Wonder Woman Coaster and Pixar Pier, according to Associated Press writer Beth J. Harpass. And her article is from the May 22, 2018 issue of the Washington Post. Orlando, Florida doesn't have a lock on theme park news this summer. Sure, Toy Story Land at Disney World and a new Fast and Furious attraction at Universal Orlando will be getting attention, but there are lots of other exciting openings around the country. Fans of Wonder Woman can ride the first coaster named for her, Wonder Woman Golden Lasso Coaster, at Six Flags Fiesta, Texas, in San Antonio. The coaster has a unique design, built on a slender, twisting monorail, with riders lined up in single seats for their 90-degree drop and an upside-down thrill. Disney California Adventure Park in Anaheim, California, plans a June 23rd opening for Pixar Pier. The site, replacing the previous Paradise Pier, will consist of four Pixar-themed neighborhoods with attractions, food, and merchandise inspired by Pixar stories and characters. One neighborhood themed on Pixar's The Incredibles movie includes a revamped Incredicoaster ride with new scenes and special effects keyed to The Incredibles 2 film opening June 15th. Another neighborhood will be themed Toy Story. Six Flags Over Georgia near Atlanta debuts Twisted Cyclone, a hybrid roller coaster with traditional wood coaster structure on a steel track. The coaster's red and black train is modeled after a classic 1960s sports car. The Time Traveler ride opened in March to great fanfare at Silver Dollar City in Branson, Missouri, billed as the industry's fastest, steepest, and tallest spinning roller coaster. Time Traveler drops riders at a 90-degree vertical angle, followed by three inversions at speeds of up to around 50 miles per hour, all while spinning. And at Cedar Point in Sandusky, Ohio, a new hybrid roller coaster called Steel Vengeance is debuting. 200 feet, that's 61 meters tall, with a 90-degree initial drop and a half-barrel roll. Here are some other openings around the country this season. We first go to California. This is the final season for Jurassic Park-themed ride at Universal Studios Hollywood in Los Angeles. The ride closes September 3rd to make way for construction of a new Jurassic World ride opening next year. Also at Universal Hollywood this summer, a nighttime light show returns on select dates to Hogwarts Castle at the Wizarding World of Harry Potter beginning June 24th. And Universal's DreamWorks Theater opens a new multi-sensory attraction called Kung Fu Panda: The Emperor's Quest. The high-tech adventure features LED lighting, surround sound, and projection mapping, a type of augmented reality that can turn 3D objects into interactive displays. An upside-down view of Mission Bay awaits riders of the new electric eel coaster at SeaWorld San Diego. The triple-launch coaster will thrust riders forward and backward, accelerate to more than 60 miles per hour in seconds, and go nearly 150 feet or 46 meters up. Six Flags Discovery Kingdom in Vallejo, California debuts Skywarp, built as the world's first dueling looping coaster, with two cars speeding around each other on double loops. Elsewhere around California, visitors will find the new Trailblazer coaster at Great America in Santa Clara, a new steel coaster Hang Time at Knott's Berry Farm in Buena Park, the new Legoland Castle Hotel, and Lego City Deep Sea Adventure Submarine Ride at Legoland California Resort in Carlsbad, and Crozanity, a towering pendulum attraction at Six Flags Magic Mountain in Valencia. In the Midwest, Six Flags Great America in Gurnee, Illinois, debuts the world's largest loop coaster called the Mardi Gras Hangover. The 100-foot or 32-meter ride puts riders on a 32 face-to-face seats and takes them through several 360-degree revolutions. Holiday World and Splashing Safari in Santa Claus, Indiana, is adding two kids' rides named for the Swahili word for elephant: the Timbo Falls Water Slide Complex and Timbo Tides, a junior wave pool. Six Flags St. Louis in Missouri opens Typhoon Twister at Hurricane Harbor Water Park, a hybrid zero-gravity water slide and wave wall. In Minnesota, the Valley Fair Park in Shakopee opened Delirious, a looping thrill ride that coils riders upside down on a seven-story, 360-degree freestanding structure with a high-speed train. In Bloomington, at Mall of America's seven-acre Nickelodeon Universe theme park, a new attraction is opening on Nickelodeon's animated preschool series Paw Patrol. Kids will recreate Paw Patrol missions in an open display experience. Down south, Kentucky Kingdom in Louisville is adding Scream Extreme and a new family ride, Rock and Roller. Battle for Ire Action VR ride at Virginia's Busch Gardens Williamsburg takes guests on an adventure with a fairy warrior named Addie through her Irish homeland in the park's Ireland village. The attraction uses a motion-based theater simulator with state-of-the-art 360-degree virtual reality headsets. North Carolina's Carowinds near Charlotte debuts Camp Snoopy, a newly expanded kids section and a climb and play area, Beagle Scout Acres. And then Pigeon Forge Snow in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, is a new year-round indoor snow tubing park with 12 lanes, an oversized family tubing lane, and a lift to deliver riders to the top of the hill. And in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic, Six Flags New England in Agawam, Massachusetts, debuts Harley Quinn's Spinsanity, a colossal swing ride. Six Flags Great Adventure and Safari in Jackson, New Jersey opens Cyborg Cyberspin, an anti-gravity gondola ride, and visitors at Sesame Place in Langhorne, Pennsylvania can take Oscar's Wacky Taxi Ride, a wooden steel hybrid family coaster with a bright yellow taxi-inspired train featuring none other than Oscar the Grouch. And with that, we have to tell you, we've run out of time for today's episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you'll be listening next time, that you've enjoyed your journey today. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, reminding you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. Questions and comments may be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.